From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for Cynthia Canty. Today, Right to Life of Michigan is not happy with Governor Whitmer's veto threat over abortion bills. So they're going to go to voters to try a workaround.
I don't mean to toot my own horn, but we are the experts in the state with regard to citizen-initiated legislation.
And then tariffs. So much talk about tariffs. But what will they actually mean for us, the consumer?
Whether it's Harley Davidson motorcycles in Wisconsin, Kentucky bourbon in Kentucky, you name it. I mean, those are the products that they're going to go after.
And Joshua Johnson is here, the host of 1A. He's talking with folks from Michigan ahead of election 2020.
Michigan is special, and it's exactly the same.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in today for Cynthia Canty. Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A, is in town. He's been broadcasting from our studios this week and talking with Michigan voters ahead of election 2020. We're going to talk to him about what he's hearing coming up later in the hour. But first, Governor Gretchen Whitmer says she will veto controversial abortion bills that were just passed by the state legislature. So Right to Life of Michigan says they will work around that veto threat to try and get the legislation into law. Genevieve Marnin is legislative director of Right to Life of Michigan. What's your group planning to do?
Well, for those of you who followed our history at all, you know that we are, I don't mean to toot my own horn, but we are the experts in the state with regard to citizen-initiated legislation. And what I mean by that is the Michigan Constitution allow citizens to go out, gather a requisite number of signatures, and then place those signatures and the proposed bill to our legislators, and then it becomes a simple up-and-down majority vote that, if they pass it, is not subjected to a gubernatorial veto.
In fact, you've done this four times in the past successfully. How confident are you this time around?
Well, we are confident that we have the grassroots. We are confident that we have the drive and the passion. The only question mark that really remains is the petition law was changed at the end of last term. And while we are confident that we will be able to work within the parameters of the new law, there are still some question marks with regard to exactly what that's going to look like.
How similar will your initiative in the language be to the bills that were passed in Lansing this week?
They should be nearly identical.
And when do you want to start gathering signatures? What's the timeline?
Well, it passed each of its first chamber. So it now needs to go to the opposite chamber and do this all over again and then go to the governor's desk. We typically, what we've done in the past is we wait to see if, in fact, the governor will veto the bill. I mean, obviously, Gretchen Whitmer has issued a statement that she will, but we want to give her an opportunity to change her mind, because what we're talking about in these bills is a very specific procedure. It's a very narrow bill. It does not ban all abortions. And maybe she'll change her mind and sign the law.
There was a Republican majority in both the State House and Senate last session, as there is now. There was also a Republican governor. Why didn't these bills pass last session with a Republican in charge of the executive branch?
You know, that was probably a better question for leadership. We did pass quite a few things. Governor Snyder was a mixed bag, and frankly, we didn't always know where he would stand on some of these things. So we did a citizens-initiated legislation with Governor Snyder. As you know, he vetoed our abortion insurance opt-out bill. So, you know, this is, gathering 400,000 signatures is no joke, and it's not something you can do every year. So it's one of those things where we have to decide when it's the right time.
What is your goal eventually for the law to be in Michigan when it comes to abortion?
You know, we would love to see Roe versus Wade overturned, and I think that's why you're seeing so many other states, both the liberal states and the conservative states. We saw New York, Vermont, Virginia liberalize their abortion laws. All of us are doing this, primarily, in my opinion, because we now have a 5-4 majority on the Supreme Court for the first time since Roe versus Wade was decided. So there is there is hope and fear, depending on which side of the fence you're on, that Roe versus Wade will be overturned and the abortion decision will come back to the states.
But didn't Brett Kavanaugh say very much that Roe v. Wade has already been litigated? And isn't Brett Kavanaugh who folks are sort of looking towards to possibly change the standpoint from the Supreme Court?
Yes, he has said that. So obviously, they're not going to wake up tomorrow morning, snap their fingers, and overturn Roe versus Wade. The proper case would have to come before the court for them to even consider overturning Roe versus Wade. And based on past legal precedents, the courts are loath to do that. They typically do not just overturn and reverse a decision. What they do is they will chink away little by little by little. Well, okay, that part's constitutional. And then eventually it has been so many holes have been put through it that eventually it will fall. And that's how it's been with other legal precedences over the years.
Genevieve Marinin is Legislative Director of Right to Life of Michigan. Thanks so much for your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Reports are suggesting that President Trump may delay a decision on tariffs on car and auto imports by up to 6 months. And Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin now says he plans to travel to Beijing soon to resume talks on the trade dispute that's rattled the global economic outlook. Detroit News columnist Daniel Howes is watching all of this play out from the Midwest. Hey, Daniel.
Hey there.
So some seemingly good news, but my guess is from your latest column, you don't think champagne bottles should be popped anytime soon.
No, because I think the president is holding auto tariffs in abeyance and as a club that he can use and wield whenever he wants between now and the next 6 months. And I think for the auto companies, that just continues this long lengthening period of uncertainty. Because you've got companies like General Motors who import a lot of vehicles, comparatively speaking, that they sell in the United States from China, Germany, principally South Korea, Canada, and Mexico. They import more vehicles for U.S. customers than any of the American producers. Ford produces almost everything that they sell in the U.S. They produce in the U.S., so they're hedged in that sense. But I think the concern is that costs really kind of get out of control. They don't really know how to manage it, how to plan for it. And I think that's one of the biggest things. Uncertainty is one of the worst things that business has to contend with.
Meanwhile, Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue is trying to build this aid package for farmers who have been hurt by retaliatory tariffs imposed by China. That's in response to the tariffs that Trump initiated. Perdue said he doesn't think the current trade battles with China will cause long-term harm to U.S. farmers. You disagree?
Well, I think you got to ask individual farmers. You know, what strikes me about this, and this is not an accident, is that Trump's actions are being, the responses to his actions, I should say, are being directly targeted at Trump country.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's automakers, whether it's steel, whether it's farmers in the Midwest, this is Trump country. We're not going to San Francisco and Boston here, by way of making the point. And so I think that is intentional on the part of the Chinese. And frankly, the EU and the Japanese, who are sitting on the sidelines watching this, are already preparing lists that would do the same thing. You know, whether it's Harley-Davidson motorcycles in Wisconsin, Kentucky bourbon in Kentucky, you name it. I mean, those are the products that they're going to go after. And the president then has to answer for that. So the longer we go here and we get closer and closer into the presidential cycle, the more this becomes an issue for the president, and I think it becomes a club that his adversaries can wield against him in his own party, and particularly in the Democratic Party.
Well, you note in today's column, quote, almost midway through the third year of his presidency, his administration has not delivered a revised NAFTA, has not improved terms with Japan and the European Union, and has not reached agreement with China. Is there an end game here?
Well, the end game is this is his promise, right? And if nothing else, Donald Trump tends to be very focused on campaign promises. But I think what he's running into here, or I know what he's running into, is the reality of partisan politics and international trade. And it's not as easy as he thinks it was going to be. I was with a group of guys over the weekend, and I said to one of them, I said, I'll make you a bet that President Trump does not get to his reelect and have a NAFTA 2.0 to his credit. Because, I mean, even if he can get some of the Republicans to help him, and I think you're starting to see that a little bit, he's pushing his own team to work out something with Canada and Mexico over the steel and aluminum tariffs. The Democrats in Congress have zero motivation to give him a political win. Zero. So, I mean, how is he going to get this NAFTA 2.0, much less an accord with China, through a divided Congress?
But in the end, election-wise, right, for Michigan, we are still hearing from plenty of Trump supporters, even here in Michigan, who are saying, yep, we understand tariffs might be bad, that they might hurt us, but something has to be done, and at least he's doing something.
Well, that's true, and I got some of that mail today, actually, saying the same thing, saying, you know, I normally agree with you, or, you know, but I think Trump's doing the right thing. It's not that there aren't trade issues with China. There are, and intellectual property clearly is one of those things. The way in which they treat foreign investment is another thing. I mean, there's a whole long list of things. But that's not what the president is focused on, at least not at the top line. And that's not what's affecting the international markets. He's focusing on taking much more of a blunderbuss approach here and essentially having a trans-Pacific bumping of the bellies with Xi Jinping, and to see who's bigger and who's tougher. And that kind of game with a personality like Donald Trump and the leader of China could not necessarily end well. So we have to wait and see how this plays out. But sure, there's no question that there are serious issues with China. But I think a lot of people would say, let's focus on the serious issues and not get in this tit-for-tat game that just makes a lot of investors around the world very nervous.
Daniel Howes of the Detroit News joins us Thursdays here on Stateside. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Still to come, a Detroit man buys a desk and then becomes obsessed with the hidden letters he finds inside of it.
Every time somebody looked at them, they came back with words like horrible, awful, terrible, I don't want to talk about it, you need to put these back.
That story is coming up after the break. And then in 20 minutes, Michigan Radio is pleased to welcome 1A host Joshua Johnson in the studio. We're going to hear what he thinks of our state. That's in 20 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in today for Cynthia Canty. A Native American tribe in the Upper Peninsula could soon be the first in the state to regulate its own surface water quality. Michigan Radio's Kayla Fond has more.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is seeking public comment on the Keweenaw Bay Indian Community's application to set its own water quality standards.
It's going to allow us to set our own water quality standards for the waters here on the reservation, where right now we follow the standards of state and federal guidelines. And we will be the first tribe in Michigan that has this authority.
That's Stephanie Cree. She's a water resources specialist for the tribe. She says if the tribe's application is approved, it would be able to regulate polluters on or off the reservation if they are affecting waters on the reservation. The tribe wants its standards to be more stringent than the EPA's, but Cree says they would still be reasonable.
We have over close to 15 years of water data that we'll look at, you know, from the waters that we've tested here over, you know, within the past. And so we're going to take all that into account.
Evelyn Ravindran directs the Natural Resources Department for the tribe. She says in the short term, the goal is to just keep water quality from deteriorating.
Where there is impairments that we see, maybe we see it as more of a long-term goal that gradually those standards change over time.
The tribe wants standards on the reservation to be more protective because its members are more exposed to environmental contamination through fishing, hunting, and gathering practices. Ravindran says they hope to someday be able to set air quality standards as well.
This is something our air program is working on, is that we're moving towards a redesignation of class for here.
She says they want air quality on the reservation to be regulated at standards similar to those for a wilderness area. Stephanie Cree says there are other tribes in Wisconsin and Minnesota that have approval to regulate their own water quality.
Just after we get approved, I hope that other tribes will follow us.
The public comment period for the tribe's application ends May 23rd. I'm Kay LaFond.
So how's this for a story? A man purchases a secondhand desk in Detroit and discovers letters in a secret compartment. He didn't know the old woman who had owned the desk or its contents, but with the encouragement of a Hollywood celebrity, he slowly unravels a tragic story. We'll turn to Mismatch podcast host Roger Weber to pick it up from here. And a quick note, there is a brief reference to sexual assault.
Helen was nearing the end of her long life. She was over 90, fighting dementia and walking with the help of a caregiver. At least her surroundings were comfortable. From her apartment, she could see lake freighters gliding down the Detroit River. Her unit was roomy and well-furnished. After years of speaking English, Helen had reverted to her native German. Der Bruder, they would hear her say, a reference to her brother. She was apparently the only person alive who knew what happened to him and to his family. The secret would soon die with her. Or so it would seem.
I can't help but wonder how many times had Helen gone into the desk and taken out the letters and reread these details and cried for the people she loved so much.
I'm Roger Weber. Welcome to Mismatch, stories of the incompatible, the unsuitable, and the out of step.
My name is Tim Mallett.
Tim is the unlikely discoverer and steadfast keeper of a stranger's story. Her family's tragedy grabbed him and wouldn't let go. But for the story to finally emerge 70 years later, strange things had to happen. Tim's purchase of a piece of junk furniture, his chance meeting with a Hollywood star, and his unlikely decision when he was in his 20s to keep an old woman's fading letters.
In my mind, I know these people very well. I feel like I've lived with them for 30 years now, so I've gotten very familiar with who they are.
So at a very early age, I got exposed to a lot of really interesting people.
He takes me to the place where it all began.
We are in Detroit, Michigan, driving down East Jefferson Avenue along the Detroit River. Okay, we're getting close here. There's the sign for the Whittier on the top. It's still there. And there used to be a...
Whittier Towers is a high-rise retirement community. Tim started working there in 1987 when he was still in college.
Do you see the windows that have the cornice on them? And then third window up, right at that court, I believe that was her apartment.
Helen Seba's apartment.
My only true memory of her is walking down the hallway at the Whittier with a caregiver. At that point in time, she was somewhat distraught.
You could say that Tim met Helen and her family after she died. Her secret was tucked inside a broken-down desk, which along with her other furniture was part of an estate sale. That's where Tim bought her desk, though it wasn't his first choice.
My girlfriend had moved out, needed a dresser, and there was a dresser. I paid $25. I can actually remember what the dresser looked like. I went to pick up the dresser, and the dresser was gone. So I spoke to the person who was conducting the sale, and I said, I've paid $25. I'm supposed to pick up this dresser. And he said, well, it's gone, and he wouldn't give me my $25 back. And I had a receipt, and he said, you can have that. And he pointed to the corner, and there was a desk, and it was really in rough shape. It was a tall, straight desk, and it had a drop-down front, and the front was twisted off, and some of the fretwork on top had been crushed. And after some consideration, I thought, well, rather have the desk than just lose the $25 completely. So I took the desk.
That desk was heavy, weighing well over 100 pounds. Tim and a buddy loaded it into a borrowed minivan, drove it to his upper flat, and hauled the desk up a steep flight of stairs.
And it's got a very nice piece to the back that has little drawers and pigeonholes for letters and cubby holes for other things, and the pigeonholes were loose. And I was going to put a set screw in the top and set the pigeonholes so they wouldn't wiggle, and I tugged on them. And a box came out, and it was a secret compartment. And my first thought was, gosh, there could be stocks, money, gold. I was really excited, and and thinking, you know, you read about those things and you read about desks and secret compartments and all of these treasures they hold. But that's not what was in there.
What was in there?
There was a passport. There was a wedding album, a green wedding album with the date of 1930 on it. And there was a leather portfolio. And inside of the leather portfolio were all of these letters, and they were in German. Some of them were in envelopes, some of them weren't. And I was struck by the dates on the letters, and the dates were from 1930s through probably the 1950s.
Could you read what was in German?
I couldn't read anything. I didn't.
Well, let's explore that a little bit. You've got a rickety old desk. You got a bunch of old letters in German that you can't understand. You're in your 20s. Why not throw them out?
That was a good question. And at the time, I was struck that if somebody took the time to hide them and put them in there, they had to say something important, and they were important to that person. So I didn't feel it would be right to throw them out. And I had the sense from the timing of the letters that, you know, they were related to the war. But again, that was just a hunch, nothing else.
So you've got the desk, you've got the letters. What happens in the following years?
Well, off and on, when I would meet somebody from Germany that was older, I would ask them to take a look at the letters. And I probably had three or four individuals look at the letters. And every time somebody looked at them, they came back with words like horrible, awful, terrible. I don't want to talk about it. You need to put these back. This is too upsetting.
Tim even asked his butcher for help getting a translation. The man's 85-year-old wife was German. He took the letters home to her, but soon brought them back. He told Tim the letters were giving his wife nightmares.
And I got the sense that there was a great tragedy that had happened. And I got some details along the way that concerned a little girl and the invasion of the eastern part of Germany at the end of the war. And
it seemed to be enough information to kind of tantalize you to hold on and keep searching.
I don't want to say it was haunting, and I couldn't get an answer. And it was always there.
So Tim held on to Helen's letters with only an inkling of what they were about. He kept them in their original hiding place, even though the desk broke apart during his move from Detroit to Dallas. He knew he should get the letters translated, but he put it off for 25 years. He began unraveling the mystery of the letters after a strange coincidence on a flight to Nashville.
And at the very last minute, this petite lady walks on the airplane, has her back to me, and she's struggling to put a bag up in the overhead.
Which is always too high for me because I'm only 5'4" and have a bad back. So it's usually a jumping experience whilst bouncing it off my head. And he realized that he didn't want to watch me do that. So he picked up my bag, did it, sat down, and looked like he was about to go to work.
She proceeds to get on the phone and look out the window and talk. And I was working on a presentation, and she started to engage me in conversation.
And then somehow or other, it got into sort of a little bit of question like, you know, are you going home? The usual kind of thing you ask someone who sits next to you to be polite.
Ultimately, the voice sounded so familiar that I looked over, and it was Jane Seymour. The actress, the Bond girl, Dr. Quinn.
No one around here has ever heard of a lady doctor.
That's a shame, Reverend. Every town should have at least one.
Jane Seymour's movies include Live and Let Die and Somewhere in Time. On TV, she starred in Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. And the same year Tim found the letters from World War II, Jane was playing a role from World War II.
I'm an American.
In War and Remembrance, she portrayed an American Jewish woman trapped in Europe. Jane says she takes more pride in that role than any other.
And she talked about going to Auschwitz and participating in the recreation of that and what a profound effect that had on her.
How did the conversation turn to the letters?
If you meet Jane, family is very important to Jane. And as she was introducing herself personally to me, she talked a lot about her family history.
And he said, you know, I've got this desk, and I just, it's like, I don't know what to do. Give me some advice. I found this desk, had it for ages. And then one day I found there was a hidden compartment, and I opened it up, and there were all these letters.
She started asking me questions, and I said, well, I really don't have the details. And she said, well, you need to have those letters translated. Promise me you will have those letters translated.
You should find out. It says somebody purposely put something that they valued and collected in a hidden compartment on purpose. So somebody cared about this material.
So you don't say no to Jane Seymour. So I did it.
She insisted.
She insisted.
So, Jane Seymour has given you a directive. What happened?
So, I found someone who was in her 20s that was very fluent in both English and German, and she took on the task of translating them for me.
One of the biggest challenges was deciphering the German handwriting. Tim remains deeply grateful to his translator, who worked for over 6 months to unlock the story.
What was your reaction when you found out what those letters said?
Gut-wrenching. Just painful. Painful.
But not all the letters were gut-wrenching. Here's one from Helen's husband, Max Seba, writing to her in November of 1939. They had fled Germany and were living in England.
My dear companion of my life, let us not try to think back. 1 year from emigration. Let us be happy that we are together again. We have to keep on going. Signed, your husband, a.k.a. Little Man, darling.
Max and Helen had been living in Danzig, a historically German city. It came under international protection after the end of World War I. Max's reference to 1 year from emigration ties perfectly into what happened in November of 1938, Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass. Anne Berg is a native of Germany and teaches German history at the University of Michigan.
Hordes of violent Nazis and Nazi sympathizers raided homes and businesses, broke windows, dragged people into the streets, beat people up. About 100 people died in these violent outbursts that were supposed to be spontaneous, but actually were not, were orchestrated. In the aftermath, the Jewish community was fined for the damages because it was presented as if they had incited this violence, and they had, I think, a billion Reichsmark fines that the Jewish community had to come up with to pay for the destruction of property that these thugs produced during that night. Synagogues burned, stores burned, and it was just excessively violent.
Helen was Protestant. Max was Jewish. The Nuremberg Laws of 1935 prohibited Jews from marrying non-Jews. Max and Helen married before that, so he had some protection. But he still would have faced enormous challenges had he remained in Nazi Germany, like continuing his career as a physician.
They couldn't live a normal life, so they couldn't practice their profession. Doctors, for example, could only serve the Jewish community. There were Jewish cultural centers, there were cinemas and other cultural institutions that would serve only the Jewish community. Parks and park benches were only for non-Jewish Germans reserved and so forth. Curfews for Jews were different than for non-Jewish Germans. And so they were basically ostracized from political, cultural, social, and economic life, unable to practice their normal existence, and were completely dependent on their non-Jewish spouses.
So for Helen, at this point in her life, things are looking up. She's out of Germany. She's in the safe surroundings of England. But what is yet to come is the heartbreak.
Well, Helen is out. Helen had a brother, and his name was Willie. And Willie and his family stayed behind.
Willie Weiss. He was a physician who grew up with Helen in Königsberg, Germany. Willie was married to Dora. Their young daughter was named Ursula. They were living in Hamburg in 1943 until British and American planes rained bombs on the city.
One of the greatest serial stories of the war, the battering of Hamburg. By night and day, the big German city was subjected to Allied air assaults without parallel in history. As each of the British night
over the course of about 10 days, at the end of July, early August, the Allies basically razed the city to the ground. The problem with this particular incident was that the weather was super hot. And so phosphor bombs were thrown and other incendiary devices, and they led to massive conflagration. So the firestorm that developed kind of sucked the air out of the city, and the water that was in water tanks started boiling. People were suffocating in shelters and bunkers and cellars and so forth. Everything kind of melted. It was absolutely horrific. The official numbers afterwards range about 30,000. People have perished in the bombings. 900,000 people left the city, were refugees.
Including the Weiss family. They relocated to the city of Neustrelitz, about 60 miles north of Berlin.
We'll continue our story, Hidden Letters, from the Mismatch podcast. That's coming up after the break. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in today for Cynthia Canty. So before the break, we heard about Helen Seba and her husband, Max. They managed to escape Germany during the final part of World War II. But Helen's brother, Willie, and his wife, Dora, remained in Germany. Let's continue the story, Hidden Letters, from the producers of Mismatch.
As Willie and Dora settled into their new home, the tables were turning on the Third Reich. The German army began a full retreat after heavy losses in the Soviet Union.
The Germans waged a war of extermination in the East. That meant that every living thing was targeted. Every village was supposed to be burned. There was nothing supposed to be left standing. As the German army marched into Poland and Russia and on the retreat, The Red Army, they came back through a territory that was completely destroyed. The Germans had burned down villages, smashed babies against walls.
Retaking town after town, Soviet forces find a ravaged country left by the Nazis. But Hitler paid a price for this wanton destruction. That price was more than 5 million Nazi soldiers.
So within the Red Army's high command, there was a tacit agreement that the sort of violent retribution was not only condoned, but kind of welcomed.
The Soviet troops entered Neustrelitz, the Weiss's new city, in the final days of April 1945.
And so within the first several days and weeks of the occupation of Germany, there were mass rapes of German women from ages about 12 to 70. In the initial phases of the occupation, those were kind of like very public. Often women were raped repeatedly by entire groups of soldiers.
Berg says the Red Army's victimization of German citizens must be viewed in the context of previous atrocities by German troops, whose government started the war.
The violence was wanton and indiscriminate. It was, however, as if the Soviet Union was inscribing total victory and unconditional surrender on women's bodies at that time. That's how I think historically this can be explained, and this is something that is really difficult to talk about because it affected almost every woman in those parts of Germany.
That's the big picture. The hidden letters revealed how one family, the Weiss family, was victimized. By the spring of 1945, the killing of soldiers, the bombing of cities, and the slaughter of innocents had raged in Europe for nearly 6 years. The Weiss family had invited a woman named Olga to live with them. She arrived as a refugee and became a witness to their story.
My dearest Mrs. Seba.
Olga wrote to Helen Seba to share the heartbreaking news about what happened to her brother and his family. It's one of the letters hidden in Helen's desk.
In the night from April 28th to April 29th, the Soviets came. The brute force, rape, and looting we were exposed to in the basement by the Soviets cannot be described.
Here's Tim Mallett again, the man who discovered, preserved, and finally understood the translated letters.
And the Weiss family was in a flat in a building where his office was, and they fled to the cellar, and they took their little girl, Ursula, Ulla, they call her, and they put her under burlap. And I believe they sat on her, and the Russians took Willie's wife, Dora, and raped her in front of him and made him watch. And at some point, the Weisses deemed it safe enough to go back up to their flat, and they took their daughter upstairs with them.
But the invading soldiers were not finished. They broke through the doors and found Ursula, who was only 13 years old. Her parents tried to hold on to her, but the men pulled her off and took her away. When they brought the girl back, they announced that more soldiers would be coming. At that point, according to Olga's account, Ursula said to her father, "Let us die." Ursula wanted her father, the physician, to inject her, his wife, and himself before the soldiers came back.
The Weisses grabbed in despair the one thing that they had always planned, potassium cyanide. When I realized that it was getting serious, I thought I was going to lose my mind. Almost on my knees, I begged them to abandon their plan. This was probably the darkest day of my life, when I saw the three people, the only ones I knew, taken in front of my eyes. Death came in a flash, and I envied it. I pleaded to Dr. Weiss, the last one to die, to take me with him.
But Dr. Weiss had only enough poison for the three of them, Ursula first, then Dora, then himself. Finally, they were motionless on a bed, with Ursula in the middle. Olga saw everything. She honored Dr. Weiss's last request.
We shrouded our loved ones in jackets and blankets and managed for them to be laid to rest next to each other. Ursula in the middle, just like Dr. Weiss wanted. I exactly know the place where they are sleeping, and I visit them every Sunday.
In Neustrelitz alone, between 500 and 700 people committed suicide as the war ended. It happened throughout Germany.
Suicides were often the only way that people felt that they could escape. And particularly in situations where then, you know, families were made to watch repeatedly the rape of their daughters or wives and so forth. Those kinds of experiences produce massive trauma. Nazi propaganda also anticipated mass violence and kind of warned Germans against what would happen to them and their women and children at the hands of the Russian beasts, and that's the terminology that they would use, if they didn't fight to the death. And that's the sort of context that I read those letters in, and when it affects you, it all of a sudden becomes personal.
President Truman announced the official surrender.
On May 8, 1945, President Harry Truman made this announcement.
I wish that Franklin D. Roosevelt had lived to see this day. General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe.
It was only 1 week after the deaths of Willie, Dora, and Ursula.
Throughout the world, throngs of people hailed the end of the war in Europe. It is 5 years and more since Hitler marched into Poland.
We can only imagine how Helen, safe in England, reacted to VE Day. She received Olga's letter more than a year later.
Now knowing the details that I know, I can't help but wonder how many times had Helen gone into the desk and taken out the letters and reread these details and cried for the people she loved so much. You know, it was fresh news, I'm certain, each time, you know, she opened the desk.
Helen eventually found out what happened to her family. Is it better in that case to know or not to know?
I think it's better to know if you're going to prevent it from happening again, or if the more these stories get told and the more real they are and the more we know what happened to the people we love, I think the more we can advocate on their behalf and others whom it's happened to.
Hidden Letters was written by Roger Weber and produced by Zach Rosen for the podcast Mismatch. Now, there is a second part to their story, describing how Tim tracks down Helen's grandson, who had no idea of what happened to his ancestors. You can find it in the second season of Mismatch, wherever you get your podcasts. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty.
The favorite part of my Michigan visit as a Floridian is not seeing snow this year. That's been kind of nice. I mean, this is a beautiful town, and it's nice to just kind of feel it a little bit more without thinking about having to bundle up.
You know that voice? That's Joshua Johnson, host of 1A from NPR, and he has been broadcasting this week from Michigan Radio and getting a better sense of our weather, but also what's on the mind of Michigan voters. It's been awesome to have you here. Hey.
Good to be here, Zoe. Thank you.
So you were in Detroit earlier this week. You were in Macomb County. You were in Lansing yesterday. What are you hearing from folks?
We're hearing a lot of different things. I mean, when we were in Macomb County, we were speaking to a gentleman named Brian DeHenno, who owns a roofing business, says he's got more business, more clients than he knows what to do with. Business is booming like crazy. He is among those voters who went for Obama and then went for Trump. And as a result, he says, of President Trump's economic policies, his business is through the roof. He has to rent out storage units because warehouse space for his materials is just impossible to come by. So part of what we were looking at is how people in the manufacturing sectors in and around Detroit in this part of Michigan feel about the economy today, who they credit for it, maybe who they blame, and how that affects their political expectations going into next year's elections. And they're all over the place. There's a wide spectrum, so there's no one view on it. But we heard from people who feel like President Trump is doing very much the right things, regardless of what people might think about his behavior or his personality, that has been useful. Other people who feel like Bernie Sanders stands a chance of winning their vote next year, and some who are concerned that the gains that have been made are temporary and that once the impact of the tariff war with China sets in, people may regret their support for President Trump. So we've heard a little bit of everything.
And you've been traveling across the country as part of 1A. Help put Michigan into context, right? So I'm asking you about Michigan voters. What does that look like compared to what other voters across the country are saying to you?
It is as complex as what voters are saying across the country.
Right.
I mean, Michigan is special and it's exactly the same. So many of the conversations that you are probably having, whoever you are, people are having in northern Colorado and they're having in Houston, like they're having them all across the country. One of the reasons why we did 1A Across America is to kind of descend on communities that we think get ignored generally during election cycles and just kind of listen to what people are talking about when the national media isn't showing up. And the ability of people to have honest, forthright, and not screaming, yelling, crazy conversations is something we've thankfully seen everywhere we've gone so far. So it's kind of heartening.
Are we as divided as a nation as we've sort of been led to believe over the past few years?
Well, there was that thing at Fort Sumter in 1860 that springs to mind. So, no, we are not that divided. I think it's that we are so intimate with one another. It's almost like we're squished together because social media, that we're so much more aware of what other people are thinking. In America's history, it was much, much easier to silo yourself because unless you went looking for a contrasting point of view, you wouldn't find it. I mean, that's why the debates between Abraham Lincoln and Stephen Douglas were so revolutionary, right? Because they were arguing in public as opposed to just making stump speeches to their bases. Now, with technology, we don't even have to go the Lincoln-Douglas route. Lincoln and Douglas knock on your door or they buzz in your pocket and they kind of force you to hear them all day long. And it makes people feel like they are just in this echo chamber, this cacophony of noise that never stops.
So again, though, some of that, and we've talked about this before, does not sell, right? And that is not what the presidential candidates often are hearing, that it's sort of that fight, fight, fight is what the media sometimes kind of gloms onto. So I'm going to make you pretend to be a campaign manager or someone who can give some advice, because here's the thing. Presidential candidates, when they're out voting, like, it's very staged, right? Like, the folks that they're meeting and hearing from, the staff knows what the questions are going to be asked. You, Joshua Johnson, are hearing from everyday people every single day, one-to-one. What would you be telling the presidential candidates right now, or Donald Trump? Like, what does the American public want to hear from these candidates?
Well, not that I would ever be a campaign manager,
yes,
but I think the candidates know what the American people want. I have to bear in mind as an interviewer that there is often a difference between what people say and what they do. You know, there's that old Nina Simone song that says, I can't believe nothing you say because I'm around and I see what you do. So there are the things that candidates say on the campaign trail. And then there are the things that they do that reporters like us have to say, well, actually, in 2017, you voted for X. And voters know that. So the candidates know that sooner or later, they're going to have to reckon with their records, especially if they continue to ascend in the campaigns. Until that point comes, you know, until the Iowa caucuses, until Super Tuesday, until the culling begins, they just need to talk to a base. They need to build a base from which to elevate their campaigns. As this campaign shakes out, the dialogue is going to get much more honest. Right now, it's not time for that. And election seasons now never end. I feel like the 2020 election has been going on since I was 11 years old. And it is seeming like it's just going to last maybe until 2028. But this is not the time to worry, I think, too much about whether candidates actually see you wherever you are on the political spectrum. That will shake out. Because our campaign season basically started the day Donald Trump was inaugurated president, it feels like it's just ongoing, never-ending, nonstop. It's not. It's early. What the candidates are saying now matters, but it will matter much, much more the further we get into the election cycle. So I'm not sure I would give any of the candidates guidance on what to say to the American people because we haven't finished the primaries yet. That person has got to worry about how to speak to the American people. Right now, candidates are focused on their bases, and rightly so.
So very quickly, talking about speaking to people, you are holding a community conversation this evening in Detroit. Tell me quickly a little bit about what you're doing.
We are indeed. We'll be at the Wright Museum in Detroit, which is one of the coolest museums
it's
I've ever seen. If you haven't stood under the Voice of God dome, what are you doing with your life? We'll be talking about Michigan becoming the 10th state in the U.S. to legalize recreational marijuana and a piece of the law that included, quote, a plan to promote and encourage participation in the marijuana industry by people from communities that have been disproportionately impacted by marijuana prohibition and enforcement, and so on. That often means people of color. And so we will be talking to African-American voters about this effort to enfranchise or perhaps re-enfranchise African-Americans in this growing industry, to deal with some of the heavy-handed law enforcement of the past, and look at that as kind of a microcosm on enfranchisement and equal opportunity and dealing with the ills of the past the way that Michiganders are dealing with this now. So it's kind of a narrower lens on a bigger issue.
Joshua Johnson, host of 1A from NPR. Thanks for giving Michigan some love this week.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
This Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Bella Isaacs, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, Adam Reyes, and Katie Raymond. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.